Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Wrestling Talk with Mayor McCall. I'm your co-host, Willie B. As always, I'm joined by my tag team partner. He's the founder, promoter, and CEO of the podcast, the Booker of the Stars, Mayor McCall.
As always, thank you, Willie B. We have a very, very special guest today. He is a wrestling legend all over the world. He has held over 30 titles in his wrestling career. He has headlined WrestleMania 4. Everyone has a price for this gentleman. Ladies and gentlemen, WWE Hall of Famer, the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase.
Wow. I think I'll carry you around with me to introduce me from now on. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for doing this with us, and what an honor. I had to. That was my feeble attempt to give a little, you know, pay tribute and ode to the late, you know, Howard Finkel. That was one of my childhood memories. That, you know, he always, you know, assented and acclimated everybody's name, and I know when, you know, he'd always like the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase.
Yeah. Yeah, I miss him. He was a good man.
Absolutely. Before we get kicked off, I just want to tell everybody, you know, how this came about, and, you know, a really cool story. I was on lunch break one night at work, and my routine is I always sit there and talk to my wife, and I treat her like a queen. I usually don't let her go for anybody and all. So I'm sitting there in my car, and my phone, I see on the screen where it says Steve Kern. I said, "Hey, babe, let me call you back." And she's like, "Everything okay? You usually, you know, never let me go." I'm like, "Yeah, I know." I said, "Steve usually texts, but he's calling this time." So I clicked over, and Steve was like, "John." I'm like, "Yes, sir." He said, "How would you like to talk to Ted DiBiase?" I'm like, "Oh, wow, are you serious?" I'm like, "Of course." He was like, "Well, how would you like for Ted to do your show?" I'm like, "I'm marking out." I'm like, "Are you serious again?" He's like, "Yeah, I've talked to Ted, and he's right here with me, and he put you on the phone." And man, what a cool story, and just how it came about.
Well, that's great. Yeah, Steve's been we've been friends for years. I mean, it's funny because when we met in Atlanta. He's from Florida originally, and but we met and became friends in Atlanta. And you know, when he and Terry went to Atlanta, instead of renting an apartment, and this is actually pretty good if you can do it, instead of doing that, he bought a house. You know, so he made an investment. So when he would leave Georgia, yeah, he'd sell the house, you know, and make some money anyway. But because he had bought a house, and Steve and I became friends, and we wanted to hook up to ride together, he says, "Look," he says, "why don't you move over to this side of town where, you know, where it's easier for us to hook up?" And I said, "Sure." So I went to and found an apartment out near in Stone Mountain, Georgia, and very close to Stone Mountain, and
home of Jake the Snake Roberts.
Yeah, and it's there. And on March the 26th, 1981, I met my wife. And that's amazing. And so I tell Steve all the time, I said, if we hadn't been friends, I said, I'd have never met Melanie.
Well, thank you, Steve.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. And is that how you got to Mississippi?
Well, you know, Mississippi, I was familiar with Mississippi before I went to Atlanta. I mean, Mississippi's part of Mid-South.
Sure.
And when I started wrestling in the summer of 75, which I thought I was just going to wrestle for the summer and go back and finish college, and things went so well, I didn't go back to college.
At the infamous West Texas State.
West Texas State, yeah. And so I stayed, and then I worked for Bill Watts. Well, Jackson, Mississippi was always part of the territory. I mean, I think at one point it was split up. It was like, I think Leroy McGurk had Oklahoma and Arkansas, and I'm trying to think of the guys that had Mississippi. Culkin with their last name, I think George Culkin and his son. Somehow when Bill Watts got in there with Leroy, they combined the two, so Mid-South Wrestling became all of Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Oklahoma. A big, huge territory, and so I spent the better part of my career you know, the first 12 years anyway, working for Bill Watts. I mean, you know, I look back at it now and I go, what a stroke of luck. You know, I, you know, Dick Murdoch was a guy who, again, another guy that came, you know, he told everybody he went to West Dutchess State, but he didn't.
Yeah, I've heard those stories that he would even show up to the alumni football game. Is that correct?
Yeah.
That's the most wrestling story I've ever heard.
he was kayfabing it back then.
Yeah, that's so good.
But Murdoch was a phenomenal worker. Anyway, he's the guy that got me booked with Bill Watts. And so at the end of the summer when I was supposed to go back to college, I did. And the person that I disappointed the most was Terry Funk's wife, Vicki.
Ah.
And she was like she said, Teddy, you got 1 year left. 1 year. Come back, finish, you're done. You know, and I just, you know, there was no talking me out of it.
You knew what you wanted to do.
It's what I had always wanted to do anyway. But by the grace of God, I never got hurt bad enough that, you know, I had to retire.
Well, let's talk about that. You're a second generational wrestler. Your father, I think I have that correct. Your father was Iron Mike DiBiase. How did you get? Correct. Is that how you got your start in the business?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I got my my dad and Dory Funk Sr. were really good friends. As a matter of fact, they had probably the longest professional wrestling match in history, a three-hour and 15-minute Texas death match.
Woo!
In the summer of 1966 in Amarillo, Texas. And I was in the sixth grade.
That's insane.
And they wrestled for 3 hours. Well, you know, not a Texas death match is like falls don't count. You can have falls anywhere, in the ring, on the floor, in the kitchen, out on the street, you know, in the alley. But the whole deal with the Texas death match is if you, as the fall, if you win a fall, then that goes away. You know, the refs go to 1, 2, 3, and then you know, you have, you know, you get to your feet and you got a 30-second time period. And when that 30 seconds is up, they hit the bell and you start again. And so that's how they did that thing. And they took them back. They took both guys back to the prospective dressing rooms to, you know, like to get looked at and to give them a little break. But in reality, my dad and Dory Funk Sr., they hard weighed each other. I mean, you know, it's like you're standing there and you're going to let this guy punch you in the face with a real punch.
Ooh.
And you know, and they did that, both of them, you know, like, you know, Funk Sr. had a great big black eye, and my dad had a big old bruise on the side of his face. And but they did that. Talk about doing business. You know, when the people, I mean, those pictures showed up in the paper the next day. And so the business got really good.
That's
after that. So anyway, story about my dad. But yeah, my dad not only was a professional wrestler, but, you know, he was a national amateur champion. In 1946, while he was still in the Navy, he won the AAU National Heavyweight Wrestling Championship.
That's incredible.
In amateur wrestling.
That's great.
Then when he got out of the Navy, he went to Nebraska, lettered in Nebraska 8 times, 4 years in football, 4 years in wrestling. You know, usually by the time you get to college, you're going to pick your sport, and that's it. But my dad wrestled and played football at Nebraska.
Thank you for sharing that. That's why these shows are so much fun. We find out so much, you know, new and interesting stuff. A couple guests ago, we had the Tennessee stud Ron Fuller on, and he explained to us, you know, what you're saying about, explained to us all about the hard way and how, like, his dad, you know, Buddy would, you know, pay extra to the guys for hard ways, and they would actually go out to places other than the arenas, just kind of out in public and, you know, pull some hard ways to get attention and all. And like Mario Galinto, he would make so much extra a week, you know, just doing all the hard ways.
Yeah. So
just amazed that even back then, I'm assuming there's probably no air conditioning in the building, and they went over three hours. That's crazy.
Yeah, and the only reason and I think they knew this going into it, that the only reason the match ended was that there's a curfew on the building. In other words, you know, that building was on the fairgrounds in Amarillo, and it couldn't be open after, I don't know what it was, 11 or 12 p.m.,
Right.
I guess it would be 12 a.m. And so the police came in and stopped it. So it was a 3 hour and 15, almost 20, 3 hours, almost 20 minutes draw.
I was about to say, so how did it, you answered my next question. I was going to ask, how did it end? What was the finish? That's actually a cool finish. Yeah. I would have beat you, but the police, they saved you. Yeah. Would have been a great promo.
Right.
Promo. Man, that's wild. That is wild. So, and by the way, we're in Mississippi. I don't know if you know that. We're right outside of Memphis. We're in Soto County. I'm in South Haven and John's in Horn Lake. So we're not too far from you, about 2.5 hours north of you.
That's awesome. Well, I still remember the first time I ever wrestled in Jackson, it was kind of like, it was all new to me. It's kind of one of those things where, like, I enjoyed coming to Jackson, but, at the time it was like, I don't think I'd ever want to live here, though.
So what was it like during those days? Would you guys wrestle in Jackson? Would you go to Louisiana? What would be your normal week in Mid-South during those days, your normal Mid-South, travel?
Well, it varied, but the basic run was we wrestled in New Orleans on Monday night. And now here, a lot of the guys, guys had apartments in different places. I had an apartment in Baton Rouge. And so JYD, that was in Baton Rouge. There were a couple of other guys. Some of the guys had apartments in Alexandria, because Alexandria is basically right in about the middle of the state of Louisiana. But I chose Baton Rouge because, Monday night was New Orleans, and that's only 80 miles from me.
Sure.
It's only 80 miles from Baton Rouge to New Orleans. And then Tuesday night was Baton Rouge. So that was almost like 2 days off, or at least 2 days at home. And then I would, then Wednesday morning, I'd drive 240 miles. And back then it was all two-lane highway. 240 miles up to Shreveport, because we would do our interviews to put in the tape for the upcoming week's wrestling matches. So we'd finish doing our interviews about noon, and then we get in our car, we drive 200 miles to Jackson. And wrestling back then, Jackson was Wednesday night. And it just depended on the week, but a lot of times we'd stay over in Jackson, and then the next night we would go up to Greenwood or Greenville.
My grandparents were Greenwood and Greenville, so
Yeah, we actually wrestled in a roller-rama. It was a roller rink.
Yep.
And they put the ring right up in the middle of where the roller rink would have been. Anyway, then we would drive all the way from either Greenwood or Greenville all the way back down to Baton Rouge. My gosh. On Wednesday night. And then Thursday, it just varied. There was a lot, Thursdays could be anything in the weekend, because we had all those places, Lake Charles, Lafayette, and then when Bill made an agreement with Paul Bosch in Houston, he became a partner with Paul Bosch in Houston, then we started going to Houston. Imagine having to, drive to Houston.
Ooh. So were you guys running two towns at that point? Were you running two different shows? Or?
Well, now he did that. There were times when he did that. What he would do. Yeah, and one crew would be in one show, and the other crew would be on the other shows. But the other thing he did was on Saturdays and Sundays, it was like we would, This was not every week, but this was bi-weekly. He would fly us to Oklahoma City. We'd wrestle. We had a matinee event at about 1 o'clock in Oklahoma City. And that was over by like 3:30. And then they had vans, and they would drive us from Oklahoma City to Tulsa, which is not just about 100 miles. and then we had another show that night. And we would do that on Saturday, and then he would fly us Sunday morning. He'd fly us all back to Baton Rouge. Sunday afternoon, we'd have a show in Lafayette, and Sunday night, we'd have a show in Lake Charles.
Ooh.
So, four shows in 2 days.
Talking about paying those dues.
Brutal. You know, Bill Watts and I are pretty good friends now. You know, I'll be honest with you, Bill's brilliant. I mean, the guy is, you know, he's one of the smartest guys I know in terms of his understanding of the psychology of professional wrestling. And then I found out, and this I found out from my good friend Terry Funk, who again just passed away as well, that Bill Watts learned the business from Eddie Graham. And he said, but Eddie Graham learned the business from my dad. So Eddie Graham learned it from Dory Funk Sr.
Wow.
Anyway,
very interesting.
It's crazy how wrestling, professional wrestling, is truly a family business. We talked about that with Ron Fuller. I think we discussed that when we had Steve on as well, just when he was talking about Eddie. It's just wild how you know, the entire, it seems like, especially during the territory days, it was truly a family generational business.
Yeah.
Well, you kind of answered my next segue I was going to roll into, because you always hear the stories and you read the articles and all, and you know, I was just going to ask you, you know, your relationship, you know, with Bill Watts, and actually what it was like working for him.
Well, you know, I mean, it was hard, you know, but you know, it's kind of like, it was one of the most successful territories as well. In other words, well, and the other thing that Bill Watts did, he's the first wrestling promoter in the history of territorial wrestling to make his featured star black guy.
Yep, JYD.
Junkyard Dog. And I mean, I'll tell you what, JYD and I mean, he was the best man at my wedding.
Correct.
Yeah.
And he was so good on the microphone. Oh my gosh. And it's like, you know, you can teach people a lot of things. You can teach guys to get in the ring and show them the moves and the holes and all that stuff, and you know, they could go through a match. But the one thing you can't teach anybody is charisma.
Yep.
You either have it or you don't. And JYB had it tenfold.
Yeah, he was a phenomenal guy. He was.
And he was. You know, had a great body. He was great on the microphone. I mean, his wrestling skills were limited, so being a heel, and eventually that's how I turned, you know, I turned heel against Dog, and you know, it's like, oh my gosh, you talk about a hot heel for a while. And I remember asking Terry Funk, you know, I said, you know, Dog is limited in what he can do in the ring. He said, Teddy, he says, you got to kind of put him in the middle of the ring, work around him.
Yep.
You have got to make all the, you know, you've got to make everything work. You got to put him in the middle of the ring and bounce off of him.
and those are things you do. I mean, he's probably at that point, I guess, the biggest draw, you know, and so you do what you got to do. And I mean, you know, that's the proof is in the pudding. You guys, you put him over and the rest is history.
How did you guys get so close? Was it, you know, just being in the locker room, the traveling together? Like, what camaraderie brought you guys being so close?
Well, I mean, that was just it, you know. I mean, when I started in the business, obviously you start, you know, when you start, you're a baby face because the heel is the guy who leads the match. So I would be on the opening match every night with a guy across the ring who led me, you know, because we have our own lingo in the ring. And the other thing about wrestling as it should be, which it isn't today, is you didn't go out and map out a damn match from bell to bell.
Right.
All I knew when I got in the ring is exactly how that match was going to end. Everything else was ad lib, and that's the gift, that's the art of wrestling, because every crowd you get in front of is not going to respond the same. And if you do something one night, you know, and then get this great big pop, and you might do it the next night, and you don't get the response you want, then you better be able to think on your feet and shift gears.
And that's what's missing from today's product. And our absolutely. Fans that listen to our show will they know I harp on this some, and I don't. It's not that I'm trying to down or insult today's performers, but
yeah.
You know that I'm not a sports entertainment fan. I'm a professional wrestling fan, and that's again whether it's in the ring or promos, the art of it. You know, letting the wrestler get the feel of what's going on, and they get on the mic or in the ring, and that's what sells us, because you can you get a feel of it, and we realize to us it becomes real at that point, and you can suspend disbelief and you're into it. Now it's they get up there and the scripted promos.
Yeah, it's scripted promos, and this is going on in the dressing room, and something's happening out in the parking lot. And I think it was Arn Anderson, who's a very good friend of mine, and I Arn's another guy that I kind of took under wing when he first started, and man, he just became one of the best. And he told me one time, because he worked for them, he worked for Vince. I tried to for a while, and I just couldn't do it. But he said, Teddy, he says, I don't think Vince likes wrestling. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, basically, professional wrestling is the bastard child of the entertainment industry. It's kind of like the low man on the totem pole. Yeah, we're sports entertainment. And he said, Vince is always wanting to try to make it something more acceptable, was the word he used. You know, like... So I don't know. I said, well, you know, whether he's making it more acceptable or not, what the fans want, the story's in the damn ring.
Yes.
And the two guys in the ring are the ones that are supposed to tell the story. The story is the damn match. And I can remember watching Terry Funk and Dory Funk Jr. both separately have matches with Jack Briscoe. Jack Briscoe was an unbelievable worker, you know, and he was the NWA world champion for a good long while. I watched both of those guys wrestle, either one of the Funk brothers, at different times, of course, in Amarillo. And I'm in college then. I'm at West Texas State playing football, but I grew up in the business. I'm smart to the business, and I'm watching these two guys have a match. And I'm jumping up out of my seat because I'm so into the damn match they're telling, the story they're telling. It was so good, and that's where it's at, you know. It's, you know, I mean, these guys, and they wrestled an hour to a draw, and the people were standing on their feet.
You know, like to piggyback and reiterate, you know, what Willie was saying and all, like, you know, just today's product versus, you know, the old school feel. I mean, these days you can do four flips, four hurricanranas, but back in the day you could tell just as better story with just doing a headlock in the middle of the ring.
Well, and see, that's the other thing. It's like, you know, a lot of these guys today, I'll watch a match and they'll do some spectacular move, you know, and, you know, I can't remember who I saw do it first, but, it, you know, it's one of those deals where you go to turnbuckle them and they do an up, they do like almost a not stand on your head, but stand on there. They put their hands on the bottom rope,
yep,
throw their body up and then come up and then bring their head up to where they're sitting on the top turnbuckle looking out of the ring. But you take that a step further, they take that bump, and when they get to the top and they're looking out away from the ring, they just go ahead and they keep going out to the floor. Now, that's an unbelievable bump. Now, I've seen guys take bumps like that and bounce right up.
Yeah, you've completely killed the point of the...
Exactly.
Too much no selling going on.
Yeah, there's no selling.
How many false finishes in a row can you have without you going, okay. You know, how many times can you hit a DDT, your finisher, and then not finish the guy? It's like,
I mean, and that's what's wrong with the business today. It's become more of an acrobatic show.
and talking about, you know, talking about the feeling and the emotion and getting the crowd, you know, heavily invested. I remember back in, you know, you were doing some work, you know, with Georgia Championship Wrestling. You know, you and Tommy Rich had a, you know, nice feud going on, which, you know, we've had Tommy on the show before. We've had the pleasure of having him. But you can just, you know, during that, you can just see the look on, like, the fans on TBS's face and everything, yeah. How emotionally invested in everything they were, and they're just totally buying into the storyline.
Yeah. Well, and hey, listen, Tommy Rich was great. Tommy was unbelievable. When I first got to Atlanta, he wasn't there. You know, I don't know where he had gone. But when he came back, you know, and obviously I did, you know, but it wasn't like you had to get him over. You know, he was still over. You know, and he and I became pretty good friends. And of course, I turned heel there too, and you know, wrestled Tommy. I did an angle there too. I think an angle that turned me back babyface, and it was the Freebirds. You know. Who was it? Not
Michael Hayes, Terry Gordy, Buddy Rose,
Terry Gordy.
Yep.
Terry that gives me a pile driver on the floor.
Ooh.
On the floor three times, and so what they had me do is I drew blood out of my arm, put the blood in a balloon. And I tied the balloon off, and I just carried it in my mouth. And when he gave me those three pile drivers, I just chewed on that balloon until it broke. And so now there's blood coming out of my mouth.
Wow.
And so when the MTs got there, I mean, I laid there. I spent 4 days in an Atlanta hospital, and there wasn't a damn thing wrong with me.
You pulled an Andy Kaufman.
Yeah, you pulled Andy Kaufman and sold it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. That was the deal, though. It's like they couldn't. They kept taking, doing all these tests, and they said, "We just can't figure out where that blood that came out of your mouth came from." I wasn't gonna tell them.
This day and time, right? He's just here trying to get a doctor's note for work. Ain't nothing wrong with that boy.
But that goes to the of how the business was back then, of just the dedication that you all put into it to truly put it over.
And also the days before the internet and the dirt sheets and all like that, you could pull off stuff like that. Today, you know, it'd be hard to do something like that. Well, within a couple hours, Teddy DiBiase's in the hospital wrestling, faking an injury.
Yeah. You know, there's no way. There's no way that you could ever do that today. You know, it's kind of like, because now if you watch a match, and then you go and you wrestle the same guy the next night, and maybe a little, you know, no two matches are ever exactly the same, but you know we would maybe do the same finish. Well, you know, that would be all over the internet, you know, in a heartbeat now. So
and like you said too, back then probably, you know, you do the same finish, but you know, two matches will never be the same, and that's what you were talking about before, feeding off the crowd. I'm not every crowd on every, you know, every night, different city, different crowd. They're going to feed off something different. So you guys had to, you know, be ring generals and make the adjustments on the fly.
Exactly, and that's, you know, and again, and I'll be honest with you, you know, like the guys today, and it's not, I'll be honest with you, it's not their fault really.
No. I mean,
and here's the reason why. The reason is, the business has changed so much that it's not available to them anymore. It's like when I started wrestling, I came into a territory and I wrestled every night in a different town on the opening match. But the guy across the ring from me was a seasoned veteran who could lead me, okay? And so night after night after night after night, I have that opportunity. Now, you know, they have a great developmental center down in Orlando, but those guys only get to wrestle in front of a crowd once a week.
Well, and what happens when those guys, they can't go anywhere else? Let's say a gimmick or who they are is not working. They don't have another territory to go try something else and reinvent themselves. So the days of having... you know, Vince, it was good for Vince financially to take over and take all the talent out of the territories and grow national. It was you know, great. At the same time, it was there went all the talent to pull from. You know, look, his biggest years were always true professional wrestlers. Your guys' generation, the 80s, everybody that was big came from a territory and was a true professional wrestler.
Yeah, and that was the from the mid-80s to the mid-90s.
Yes.
You know, and I hear that from the fans all the time. That was the last great era of wrestling. And basically only because the opportunity to learn the business the old way doesn't exist anymore. And that's not their fault.
No.
You know, down there in the developmental center, you know, they teach them all the guys that are training down there are good. I mean, my gosh, you know, Terry Taylor's down there. There's another guy. Terry Taylor is a very good friend of mine. Was an unbelievable worker, but never really got a break.
I agree with that. Terry, if you watch Terry Taylor's matches and a lot of that vintage footage, Terry Taylor is one of the best workers to ever lace up a pair of boots in professional wrestling. He really is.
You know, and I don't know if you could say there was a lack of charisma there. I don't think so. He's really good.
Not to insult Terry or anybody else, but I hated the Red Rooster gimmick. I just could not stand that. That did not do it for me.
Well, hey, guess what? He hated it.
it's one of those that I heard you don't bring up to him and would never insult him that way. And when I think of Terry Taylor, I don't think of the Red Rooster. It's like I think of the old Mid-South days and or the UWF when they merged with Crockett and he had a big feud with Nikita Koloff and so there was. Yeah. You know, there was just so much. He had such a good library and background of matches. It's more than just the brief stint with a bad gimmick.
I just bring that up because it was such underutilization. It's just so much more could have been done with a talent like Terry Taylor.
Yeah, I agree. I wholeheartedly agree.
And to move on a little bit, you were so in '87 when Vince came calling. There is rumor we read about that you were. I guess you were up to be, you were being groomed or potentially to be the NWA champion. What changed your mind? What was the big decision maker for you to maybe not stick with Crockett or Bill Watts and maybe take over for Flair, take over that title or to move on to the WWF?
Well, it's like this, you know, and it's true that, you know, I can remember, I can't remember the first time I went to, Georgia. I went to Georgia and left Mid-South because I had a phone call and a conversation with Terry Funk, and he said, "Ted, he says your name's in the hat as possibly being one of the next guys to be the NWA World Champion. The other two names in the hat were Ric Flair and Dusty Rhodes, and as we all know, both Ric Flair and Dusty Rhodes." Had their run with the title, and I guess that was it. It was that because you know, I spent so much time with Bill Watts, and Bill Watts wasn't affiliated with the NWA. He was not an NWA. You know, it's kind of like you know the NWA World Champion never came to our territory because he wasn't affiliated with it, and. I guess it was just that, but I mean, the first time I went to Atlanta, it was Terry saying, "Go to Atlanta, get on the TV," because that obviously was the TV that the only coast-to-coast cable network. And he says, "Go get on that TV and get over," and that's what I did. So the rest is history, as they say. And you know, I missed out, but.
But Vince came calling.
You know, it's like, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like in '87. The other thing that, you know, when Vince came calling is that I had, you know, Stan Hansen and I are very good friends. Stan Hansen's another guy. Another guy that played football, West Texas State. And Stan became one of the biggest draws in Japan in terms of what they call a Japanese term for foreigner is gaichi.
Yep.
They love Stan over there.
And they loved Stan Hansen. And Stan came to me. He said, because when Brody and he were partners, Brody jumped ship and went to the other company, New Japan Wrestling. I was like, he must have got a heck of a deal. And so Stan came to me and he said, I need a new partner. Are you interested? And I said, are you kidding? I said, is a pig's ass pork?
Yeah, yeah, that's the same way I felt when Steve called me and said, would you like to talk to Ted DiBiase? That's the same thing I should have said.
But so, yeah, so I teamed up with Stan, and now I'm going to Japan, and oh my gosh, and I'm making better money than I ever made, you know. And the tours were, some tours were 2 weeks, some were three, some were five, but you know, they were divided up. So you'd go for a month and you come home, you'd be home for 2 or 3 weeks, or you might even be home a month and then go back to Japan. But because when I picked the paper up, I think I was in a hotel in Baton Rouge, and it said WWF sets indoor world attendance record, WrestleMania 3.
Yes,
93,000 people.
Pontiac Silverdome.
And I said, if I'm going to stay relative in wrestling, I'm going to have to go to work for Vince McMahon, because I just saw that's where wrestling was going. And, you know, that's the deal. I mean, you know, and Vince went around, he went around to all the territories and talked to all those promoters, and he told them all what he was doing. He even invited them to join him. And of course, Bill being as smart as Bill was, Bill knew they weren't going to do it, you know, because they all had their own egos, and it's kind of like, you know, so you think you're, you know, I don't know.
They wasn't quite ready to join the machine.
No. I'm talking about Vince. Vince, you know, went around to all those promoters and invited them to join him. I think already knowing it is, and had they, I think there were a couple. I think the Briscoes down in Florida, they understood what you know, where it was going and what was happening. But you know, a lot of them did, because they had egos, and they were going to do it their way. They're going to have their own territory and all that other stuff. So, but again, to Vince's credit, he gave him an opportunity. But that's, you know, that when I saw that, I knew, I said, this is at some point. And so then, you know, Bruce Pritchard and I are good friends. And so I was making good money. I was working for Bill Watts in Mid-South. And that was, as far as the way that territories go, was one of the best paying territories in the country at the time. And then I had this great deal in Japan, which was fine with Bill, you know, and he liked that, because then he could shoot angles, you know, and I'd leave for 3 weeks or 4 weeks and then show up again. But, I was talking to Bruce Pritchard, and Bruce told me, said, and Bruce always, he worked for Paul Bosch, you know, way back when, before he ever went up. Anyway, Bruce told me, you know, in Houston, I'm at a show there, and he says, I'm fixing to go up to New York and see about getting a job. And so I said, hey, I said, you know what, you know, I'm leaving for Japan, but he says, hey, throw my name out there. I said, I was up there once. The first time I went to New York was like in 80, I don't know, maybe 77 or 78, I can't remember. But, you know, I wasn't there very long. I was
79. You were the
WWF North American Heavyweight Champion. Yes. 1979. WWF.
Yeah, that's right. They brought me in as the North American Champion.
Yeah.
And see, they, you know, because the promoter, all the other promoters, like they had a great relationship with the guy at St. Louis. I'm trying to think his name right now. Oh gosh. Anyway, but because a lot of these promoters put my work over. Well, back then, though, New York was, you know, New York was in that, you know, they wanted all their guys to look like they just came off of Muscle and Fitness magazine. And I didn't look like that at all. You know, back then, you know, I mean, I had even played college football, and I was just big. I didn't have, well, I'm in great shape, whatever, but that came later. When I went back to work, when I signed the new contract with Vince Jr., you know, I remember he said, "Ted, I'd like to see you visible in the gym." And I said, "Oh, don't worry about it." So that was 87 is when I had that conversation. But anyway, the way it all happened.
Bruce called you, and Bruce Pritchard goes,
and I said, "Yeah, hey, throw my name out there, see what, you know, if anybody buys." So I go to Japan. And I come back to the hotel one night, and there's a message at the front desk. Call Bruce Pritchard ASAP. I said, "Oh, gosh, what's up?" So I call Bruce, and he said, "Well, two things have happened. A couple things. Number one, I got a job with Vince in the WWF. And he said, when you get back to Mid-South, Bill Watts will no longer be your boss." I said, "What?" He sold his territory to Jim Crockett. And I said, "Really?" And he said, "And the other thing that you need to know is when you go back there, don't you dare sign anything for anybody until you have a chance to talk to Vince McMahon, because he's extremely interested in you." And I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yes." And so I went home and waited for the call, and I flew up to New York, and I can still remember having the conversation with Vince, and he just kind of told me what he was doing and how he was expanding, and I could see where wrestling was going. And he said, "I've got an idea, Ted." And he says, "It's, you know, everything's been done in wrestling." He says, "But this is unique. This is new. It's fresh." And he said, "But I can't tell you what it is unless you agree to come on board and sign with me, because I don't want to give away a great idea." And so I said, "Okay." And it's not, you know, I was trying to be, like, I remember Terry Funk telling me, "Don't be too anxious." And I said, "Well, I need to think about it." And then he says, "I understand that. You know, you go home and think it over and give me a call." And of course, you know, first person I called was Terry Funk, and I told him what Vince had said to me. And he says, "Teddy," he says, "if he's got a new idea and he thinks you're the guy for it, he's back to back, don't look back, go." Well, I thought that's what you'd say. And so I called Vince, and I said, "Okay, Vince, I'm your guy. What is it?" And he said, "Nope, I'm not going to tell you on the phone." And he flew me back to New York.
He flew me back.
And to the office, and I brought Melanie with me. While I'm in there, then that's when Vince laid this whole thing out. He said, "The one thing everybody hates is somebody who's extremely wealthy and bullies people with their wealth. It's kind of like, you know, like a bully on the playground. You know, the big guy who just pushes his weight around and gets away with it because he can." He says, "Everybody hates a bully." He says, "But, you know, when people start throwing their money around and bragging and boasting, you know, they hate guys like that too." I said, "I can't stand guys like that myself." Yeah. And he said, "That's basically the essence of this character." And he said, "And we're gonna try to make the public believe that you're really that guy as much as possible." "How are you going to do that?" He said, "Well, you're going to fly everywhere first class."
Okay.
the only two guys that got that kind of treatment back then were Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant, because they were the two biggest stars, and they were the two of the biggest bodies who, realistically, Andre couldn't sit in the seat if he had to.
No.
And so, where was I?
So you said you're going to live the gimmick. I know you were shown with cash, he would give you. It seemed like I've read that he gave you wads of cash to make sure that you could live the gimmick.
I signed the contract with him, and his secretary came out and counted out $2,000 in $100 bills.
Man,
it put him in my. He says, "This is your flash cash." And he says, "Every time he says, I don't care." He says, "Think about being like a cashier at a store, and somebody comes in and buys a pack of gum and throws down $100 bill. You know how angry that guy that's got to make change for that $100 bill is because you didn't have a dollar. It's kind of like it's like anyway."
So Ted, now I want you to do that everywhere you go. That's the new you.
Yeah, well, and he would do that. He said, you know, walk in, pick your spots, and then he said, if you abuse it, if you do this too much, then you're going to lose it. But he says, I just want the word to get out there. He says, you're in a restaurant, you stand up, you announce yourself, Teddy Biasi, the $1 million man, WWF. Tonight's your lucky night because I'm picking up your check, and. You know, of course, Virgil came along. Virgil would go over and pick up everybody's check, and they'd add them up. I'd throw down $100 bills, take the receipt to Vince, and he would replenish the money.
Wow. And here's a testament of how much Vince actually thought of you. I have read, and hopefully there's truth to this, where at that time, if Vince was to go out and create a character and wrestle himself, he would have been the $1 million man.
Yes.
So that's how much he thought of you to give you that.
I tell people that. I said, if Vince could have been a character in his own show, he'd have been the $1 million man. And later, you know, when he started getting more involved in the show, he almost was that character.
Yes, he took essence of. You could see flashes of you, like he, you know, when he became Mr. McMahon. You could see the rich billionaire, evil owner, the boss. You could see those traits.
So pretty much after you became, you know, 1987, you go there, then the rest is history. You become, you know, the $1 million man. You were pretty much, you know, shot up to main event status and, you know, playing with the big boys almost all at once. You were just put right in the scene with them.
Yeah. I think I signed I think I first went there in March or April. And then by the end of the summer, I remember telling Vince, I said, you know, I've got these obligations, you know, like with All Japan Pro Wrestling that I have to fill, you know, and he appreciated that, you know, because a lot of guys would just, you know, say, screw them.
Forget where they came from.
Yeah, and so I made sure I got all that done, and so then the first thing we did, you know, we started going out and doing, you know, we did those vignettes everywhere. Oh my gosh, I mean,
some of my favorites as a child.
Oh yeah, all that stuff. I mean, the people hated me before they ever saw me live. They watched all those vignettes on TV, and I mean, the first night I walked out in front of a live crowd, they booed me out of the building. Here comes that pompous ass.
And you can just rub people the wrong way with that damn laugh of yours.
Well, and that's the other thing. You know, the laugh happened by accident, and here's how it. Now this is, I'm already working for Vince. I'm doing shows and all. And so we would always do our interviews at the TV shows. And they'd have a room for, what was his name? That interviewed us all the time.
Oh, Gene Okerlund, Mean Gene.
Yeah. And so I'm cutting my interviews that for the next week's towns, right? Because they're going to insert those interviews in the locations where they're going to be seen. Anyway, so I'm doing my interviews. And I just happened to finish the interview, and I laughed like that. Well, I get my deep voice from my biological father, who was a professional singer and had an incredibly deep bass voice. Unfortunately, I couldn't carry a tune if it had handles on it. But so Vince hears me, and he came over and he said, "Ed," he said, "that's the $1 million man." He says, "I want you to end every interview you do with that laugh." So once again, it was Vince's call. And so I tell everybody, I said, I was an active wrestler in the business for almost 20 years. I stopped wrestling physically and I became a manager. The third guy. I did all that. And I got 25 years in wrestling. And what the hell does everybody remember?
The laugh. Yes, yes. Well, and it's not only the laugh, your theme song as well. And so were you one of the first wrestlers to actually, I don't know, sing or talk on your own theme song?
I don't think so, but I know...
It was genius.
Easily top three most iconic theme songs ever.
And you know who wrote all those?
Jimmy Hart, our man from Memphis.
Jimmy Hart. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, we had the pleasure of meeting Jimmy a couple weeks ago. Really awesome, cool guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is. He's a great guy.
Yeah, love Jimmy. He's been really, really kind to me personally. So what was it like to headline WrestleMania 4 with I know you had to do all the matches through the tournament, but to headline at the end with Randy Savage?
It was awesome, you know, and that's the thing. It's what's crazy is like a year earlier. I mean, it's like again in a year's time. I mean, I go from picking up a paper and saying, "Oh my gosh," you know, I'm gonna eventually have.
You read about WrestleMania 3, and then a year later, you're headlining WrestleMania 4. It's yeah. Wild. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And of course, WrestleMania 4, you know, in terms of building, it was kind of a letdown because we wrestled in a much smaller building in Atlantic City. But, I mean, that wasn't what it, I mean, it wasn't the house that you drew there. It was pay-per-view.
Yes.
That's where they made their monies on pay-per-view. But it was kind of a letdown. Like, I mean, I see this great big, you know, I think the biggest venue that I ever ended up wrestling in is when Mike Rotunda and I were IRS and the Million Dollar Man, Money Inc. We wrestled we wrestled Hawk and Animal, the Freebirds.
LOD.
In
Wembley Stadium
in Great Britain, in London, Wembley Stadium. Yep. Yeah, and I think that was 88,000 people.
Yeah, SummerSlam 92. That was one of the biggest. Yeah. Where Bret Hart and Davey Boy, they were headlining for the Intercontinental title. That was a huge show.
To back up a little bit and set the stage how, you know, the headlining at WrestleMania 4, you know, came about, which as a child I was always a huge, huge fan of the heels, and my least favorite character on WWF always ruined everything I wanted to happen was that damn President Jack Tunney. the main event, you know, February 5th, 1988, you'd approached Hogan before this and asked him, you know, could you, you know, buy the belt and all, and, you know, and he's like, "No, DiBiase, you're going to beat me in the middle of the ring for the strap. You know, you're not getting it like that." So, you know, Andre had pinned Hogan on, you know, the main event. Then shortly after that, you know, surrendered the belt to you. Then that damn Jack Tunney, he came on there and declared the WWF title, you know, vacant. So that set up the screen for to have the tournament for you and Macho to headline WrestleMania 4.
Yeah, that's it. And originally I was going to win that.
I was going to ask that. Can you talk about that? I was going to ask that.
I was originally that was the thought. And, you know, and then again, I think it, and of course I didn't know any of this, you know, at the time, I only learned about it much later, is that, you know, Randy Savage wasn't happy. And I guess Randy had been there and hell, one of the best hands they had. And so instead of me having the match with Hogan and beating Hogan or even whatever, I end up with Savage in the last match. And he goes over and he becomes the champion. And but I still went around with Andre wrestling Hogan and Savage all over the country.
How was that? What was your relationship like with Andre?
Andre, I loved Andre. Andre was great. And of course, you know, Andre being his size, Andre was limited to what he could do, but I mean, I could bounce all over that ring. And so, Andre, I had a great relationship with Andre.
And to let, you know, we try to educate everybody, you know, the fans, and let them know, you know, the wrestling history and all, like, and the part of the history being when you had bought, you know, the title from Andre or whatever. You know, the same thing had been done in the early 80s in Georgia Championship Wrestling when Larry Zbysko paid Killer Tim Brooks, you know, $25,000 for the NWA National Heavyweight Championship. So that was almost a flashback to that being done previously.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What was your I've read the different, you know, read the different articles and heard different interviews and all. What was your relationship with Virgil, you know, doing, you know, during the heyday run and versus, you know, maybe in later years, you know, what was that relationship like?
I had no problem with Virgil, you know, and his real name is Mike Jones. And, he was simply, I mean, he was hired, I'll be honest with you, for his look. Yeah, unbelievable body, and a guy who was very dedicated to staying in shape and what have you. But it's kind of like sometimes, you know, it's like the lights are on but nobody's home. You know, it's kind of like he wasn't this sharpest guy in the world. I'm just being honest, and he did everything properly. I mean, everything, of course, he didn't have to do much, and if he had had any kind of real wrestling talent, we could have because of that relationship, him being subservient to me, and oh my gosh, there's no way you could do that on TV today.
You'd
have everybody and their dog like calling you a racist.
So what's the name, but, Virgil? Is it true that was kind of a dig at Dusty Rhodes?
It wasn't a dig. It was like a rib.
Rib, yeah.
I said, well, what are you going to name this guy? Everybody said, somebody said, Virgil. Like Virgil Runnels? And I said, that's it. That's the one.
And to let everybody else know, the other rib too was, your finish, being an inverted, Cobra Clutch was the $1 million dream, a shot at the American dream, Dusty Rhodes.
Tell us a little bit.
Which again, Dusty and I love Dusty Rhodes. Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch were a tag team years before. I mean, they'd been to Australia together and everything. The first time I met Dusty was at Dick Murdoch's house in Amarillo, Texas. But I was an admirer of Dusty for his wrestling talent. So there was never any real. It's kind of like and then when Dusty became when they put the polka dots on him.
Yeah.
You know what? That was kind of a rib. I don't know. I don't know the whole story there, but I'm going to tell you what. He took it,
ran.
Made it work.
That was a great feud, with you and Virgil, and then Dusty and then Miss Sapphire. John and I were young kids during that time, so that's some of our first memories of WWF wrestling is during that time period. And that was just one of the great feuds of that era.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I love Dusty. I mean, the man, and then obviously, you know, later, you know, I stopped wrestling and managing and all that other stuff, and I left for a while. They brought me back to be like a one of the producers, they call them. And I had the hardest time with that. And I'll tell you why. Because I grew up in a business where the only thing I ever knew when I walked in the ring was to finish. Now you're asking me to be a producer and sit down with two wrestlers and map out a damn match. I said, I can't do it.
You guys were used to mapping out your own stuff.
I don't know if it was so. I don't know if it was so much. I couldn't do it. Is that I just refused to do it.
So how? And not only that, because you had spoken earlier about like what John just said, that you, when you guys got in the ring, you know, the heel called the match. Like, you did it on the fly, yeah, in the ring. Because you were trained professional wrestlers, what was it like not only to have to do that? You just explained you didn't like it, but what was it also like having to go from, you know, you were injured, you had a, you know, I think the doctor told you if you wrestled again that was gonna, you could be paralyzed. What was it like having to go from being an active wrestler in the ring to not being able to do that anymore?
Well, it definitely was it was a big change for sure, you know. But I mean, again, I was about to turn 40, and one of the things that I mean, you know, when I married my wife, you know, we got married on New Year's Eve 1981, and I told her, I said, you know, my dad had a heart attack and died. He didn't die in the ring, but as a result of that heart attack, he didn't make it to the hospital in time. And he was only 45 years old. And I said, I'm not going to stay too long. I've seen so many guys keep going and keep going. I mean, and I'll be honest with you, one of those guys was a guy who I admired so much, was Terry Funk.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, Terry ended up beat up and not being able to walk well and all that other stuff. You just can't beat your body up like that forever.
No. And how's
so
your...
I told my wife, I said, you know, I said, 40's it. I hit 40. I said, I can be a manager, I can be a commentator. I said, but my wrestling career is going to be over. And I did it.
Body-wise, how much compared to some of your... contemporaries, is your body, do you feel like you're in better shape today because you stopped at 40?
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of like in trying to, I mean, I who did I see? Well, I saw Stan Hansen, you know, at a couple of things. One of those being probably Terry's funeral, Terry Funk's funeral. And you know, and Stan's a great biker, but you know, when you watch Stan walk now, you know, he's a little he's leaning forward a little bit, like kind of like humped over a little bit, you know, and just, I don't know, you know, I can still walk upright, you know, not, and I really believe it's because I stopped when I did.
I have full confidence. I've seen some videos and stuff of you, you know, lately, and I have full confidence in you that you could, you know, come up here and visit us and put Willie B in the $1 million dream. He'd go right to sleep. I still got confidence in you, Ted.
Well, you know, I did that. They did that thing with me on NXT, a year or so ago with Cameron Grimes and LA Knight.
With the $1 million championship?
Yeah. And so, you know, it's kind of like they said, now when we do this thing on TV, you know, and you're in the ring and what have you, it's kind of, and you end up squaring offices. He says, we're gonna, when he hits you, we'll there'll be other guys in the ring, but when he hits you, you'll have one guy on each side of you, and they'll kind of catch you and lay you down easy. And I said, I ain't doing that shit. I said, you tell him to get the F out of the way, because I'm going to take a bump like I always took a bump, and quite frankly, show some of these young punks how to do it.
That's done.
Awesome.
That's
nice.
Just what I did. So I did it.
Did your body, was your body sore the next couple of days?
Actually, it wasn't. I mean, that was, I mean, you know, the other thing is, before I said any of that, I had checked the ring. You know, a good wrestling ring, you should be able to stand in the middle of it and just bounce just a little bit. It's got a little bounce.
That's the art of a ring general, you know, checking the equipment out.
Yeah.
So
I wanna. We talked about Dusty Rhodes, so I wanna back up a little bit. So Survivor Series 1990, it's your team against Dusty Rhodes' team, and you know, to let the audience know, your mystery partner, tell everybody who your mystery partner was that night, who you debuted in the WWF.
Well, he was a great big guy.
He was a big old scary looking guy. Who was that, Ted?
Yeah. I can't even remember his real name, but I mean, I know he'd been Zeus is what they called him, right?
Oh, we're talking about the Undertaker.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No, we weren't talking about Zeus from No Holds Barred. Yeah, you did. You had some classic.
I'm getting to be an old fart.
Oh, it's okay. No, we're talking about Mark Calloway, the Undertaker, the Phenom.
Oh yeah,
Survivor Series 1990. That was your mystery partner. You introduced him. He came out there with Brother Love.
Your good friend Bruce.
Yeah, that's right. And nobody had any idea how far that would go.
Did you know much about Mark before that debut came about?
No. No, I didn't know him at all.
Wow.
I didn't know him at all. And of course, but to pull off what he pulled off, I mean, that's hard to do. I mean, you know, like get in the ring and it's almost like wrestling in slow motion.
Yes. His slow walk to the ring alone, that's underappreciated. Just the pace at which he would walk to the ring.
You know, we're Memphis guys. He was the master of pain in Memphis. Then, you know, we got to see him as, you know, young children, as, you know, doing some work with, you know, Dangerous Dan Spivey, the Skyscrapers. I believe him and Sid Vicious were tagged. I believe that was one variation of the Skyscrapers, if I'm not mistaken. Hell, I'm getting old too, and I can't remember everything, but I believe that's correct. But yeah, we'd had a glimpse of, you know, his talent, his charisma, and probably, you know, what he could do if given a chance. But like you said, nobody knew the Undertaker character was going to have that longevity and blow up, you know, like it did. Just an awesome, awesome character that stood the test of time.
Yep, absolutely. And he dang sure did it, man. He sure did.
Well, did you, I know we don't have to keep you all day, but did you ever wrestle Memphis? If so, what are your memories of that?
Wrestle what?
In Memphis, at the Memphis territory.
You know what? I never did.
Wow.
I never wrestled the Memphis territory. And what's funny is I think they called themselves the Mid-South.
Yeah, Memphis, and when you're in the Memphis area, it's always referred to as Mid-South. Mid-South area.
Yeah, that's what Bill Watts called us, Mid-South Wrestling. So anyway, but yeah, I don't, you know, no, I tell you what, I live in Jackson, Mississippi. I'm 200 miles straight south of Memphis.
Yeah.
And, my biggest hero in Memphis is Elvis Presley. Right. In my opinion, he is the greatest entertainer ever. I don't care what the genre is. I don't think anybody is ever been or will be as famous as Elvis Presley was.
Agreed.
And yeah, I totally agree with that.
And I personally was a huge fan. I mean, I can remember, and I tell you what's you know Mike McGurk.
Yes, the ring, the lady, the infamous lady ring announcer. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Mike McGurk is the daughter of Leroy McGurk. Her dad was the guy who owned that territory. That's who Bill Watts bought it from, was Leroy McGurk. And Mike, Leroy McGurk, that's the story I was told. He wanted a boy so bad, when he had a girl, he named her Mike anyway. Yeah.
I've heard some interviews of her. She's talked about her dad, and she's also one of those that she belongs in the WWE Hall of Fame. Hopefully she will make it in there someday.
Yeah, and it's like, I was young, and I had gotten into a marriage I shouldn't have gotten into, and it was on its way out anyway. And when you get married, a 20-year-old guy has no business getting married.
Amen.
You don't even know what you're doing anyway. But anyway, Mike and I hit it off, and so the one thing that we both shared is this thing for Elvis Presley, and apparently the NWA used to do their big annual event out in Las Vegas, where all the promoters of the territories would meet in Las Vegas. Well, apparently that's where Mike McGurk and her mother saw Elvis, because he was out there all the time. And so I can remember she called me and she said, "Ted," she said, "are you going to be here? Blah 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 blah, whatever it was." And I said, "Yes, why?" She said, "Elvis Presley is coming to Tulsa." And so I said, "You're shitting me." She said, "No." And so she got the tickets, and I went to see Elvis Presley with Mike McGurk. And apparently she had met some of these people, because Elvis was a fan. Elvis was a wrestling fan. And I didn't know that either. I'm trying to think of the old wrestler who...
He was probably a big fan back in the day of during Memphis time, probably Spudnick Monroe, Billy Wicks, that era.
Well, a lot of people don't know this either. Before he had passed away, there were actually talks, and I believe they're going to set up a Jerry Lawler versus Elvis match with Elvis, bringing karate to the table.
If that's not the most Memphis gimmick you've ever heard of, I don't know what is.
Memphis made, Memphis bred.
Yeah, but... I go to this, and they held it on Oral Roberts University is in Tulsa, and I guess they had a great big auditorium, and that's where he was, and I got to see the King, buddy, live in person. That show that he did, and he did it everywhere. I mean, they were even all over the place, and so. As we were sitting there, and the roadies were setting stuff up, his Elvis's team, they were setting things up, getting ready for this performance of his. And apparently, Mike spotted somebody and ran down there and talked to him. And she comes back and she says, "They're staying at whatever hotel. They got the suite up the top of the hotel, and we're gonna go." And I thought, man, I'm gonna meet Elvis Presley. Holy shit! And so the show was over, and we're leaving. The show was great, and I can't remember what it was, but we got in an argument about something that was so stupid, but it never happened. We got this big fight, and we didn't go meet Elvis. And I still kick myself in the butt for that.
Man,
that's why you don't get married to 20 people. I'm a huge, huge Elvis fan. I've been to Graceland numerous times. I think Elvis is one of the all-time greatest, performers ever. And and it's funny because Willie B had the same exact reaction you had to Elvis. I'm like, "Hey, Willie, Ted DiBiase is going to be on our podcast." He's like, "You got to be shitting me."
Very excited. Very excited.
Ted, we won't keep your time anymore, but I can't express and convey to you what an honor and privilege it's been to have you on our show this morning and have your time and talk wrestling with you. What a prestige honor, and I can't thank you enough, Ted.
Well, thank you guys for having me on, and thanks for being such big fans of what I love most in life. It's wrestling. It's kind of like you know, how can I, you know, and if it weren't for fans and fan support, I said, I tell the fans that all the time. I said, if it weren't for you guys, I'd have never had a job.
Well, right. And we were, and, you know, of course, we were representing Steve, too. So I hope we lived up to your expectations and did a good job for you, sir.
Yeah. And Steve is one of my, you know, again, one of my best friends. I was with him the night his firstborn was born.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's, yeah, Steve, you talk about a good guy. I mean, Steve is super. I actually moved to that side of town. I think I told you that. I moved to the other side of because I was way down near the airport in Atlanta. He was out in Stone Mountain area, and I moved out there. Had I not moved out there, I would have never met my wife. So absolutely. I tell Steve all the time. I said, I have to thank you for, thank you for thanking you, because if it weren't for you, I wouldn't be married to Melanie.
And once again, thank you so much for doing this. So why don't you close us out with the Million Dollar Man laugh?
Well, that's what I always do, and I tell everybody the same thing. It's been great to be on. It's been great to reminisce about my career and all those things. But there's one thing that is as true today as it will be tomorrow and every day going forward, and that's this: everybody's got a price for the Million-Dollar Man.
can't beat that. Can't beat that. That with that, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to close the show. Thank you so much, Ted, for being on. That is wonderful.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ted.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.